Hey, and welcome back to Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. My name is Mark Pattison, former NFL player, now climbing the seven summits, Everest in front of me, and welcome to another amazing pod. Okay, the quote of the week: if you are not in the moment, you are either looking forward to uncertainty or back to pain and regret. That was by the actor Jim Carrey, and I think my guest this week falls into this category because he absolutely has lived in the moment and lived in the moment by really being around and setting other people who have accomplished amazing things. His name is Don Yeager. He's been in the likes and in the presence of Oprah, Shaq, John Wooden, Michael Jordan, Zig Ziglar, and was there in the end with Walter Payton. He's written 28 different books, and he was originally a editor and writer for Sports Illustrated. So we just had access to all these amazing people. And I'm so fortunate and blessed to have had him on the pod. He's now going around the country and really shedding the light and speaking to all these different groups on how to achieve greatness by studying what these different players and teams did. So he's really come up with these 16 characteristics. So stay tuned for the pod. It's really cool this week. Just an amazing guy, and really love my time with him. And if you haven't already done so, and I keep reminding people this, go on to iTunes and go in and rate and review. The way that the Apple world works is that by more reviews and ratings, it goes up in terms of popularity. And we're really trying to spread the news and the word of people can overcome anything, especially when you start listening to some of these different stories. And then you can add in perspective that maybe your life isn't quite as bad as what you may think it is. And so it helps all of us, it helps me certainly to be inspired and keep going. And that's the bottom line. So go in there and do that. And also, if you know somebody who'd be amazing for this pod, please let me know. You can do that on my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. I've got some new speaking reels that that I put on there, and books, and the podcast, of course, and things like that, as well as an e-learning course. So really fired up to have a new sponsor, Cascade Mountain Tech, that is now with me on the journey as I continue to go forward. And so more about them during the pod. Okay, so on that note, let's go listen to Don. Here we go. Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And I love this guest this week. His name is Don Yeager, and I love this guy because he is in a vertical that I have long been in, and that is within the sports world. He is an author of 28 different books. He was a longtime editor for Sports Illustrated. He is a world traveler. He's a public speaker. And he's had an amazing amount of people either on his show interviewed or vice versa. Oprah, Shaq, John Wooden, Michael Jordan, Zig Ziglar, been on CNN, Pete Carroll, Walter Payton, and the list goes on and on and on. So first of all, Don, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. Listen, I'm beaming all the way from Sun Valley, Idaho. We just talked about that. I'm right at the base of the mountain by the River Run Lodge. So we're going to have to connect at some point in time when you make it out here. And you are on the other side of the country in Tallahassee, Florida. And the first thing I want to ask you, because so much about your theme has been this study of about how to become great. No, it's really the 16 characteristics, there we go, of greatness. And so what I want to ask you is, what have you done to separate yourself from your competitors? Because I know this is a question that you often ask people that you interview.
That is the question, actually. And so I would tell you what I think I've done to separate myself from competitors is I have really worked to master the art of storytelling. If I can tell, I think they're just, you know, there are a lot of folks out there who have, who are probably more linguistically gifted. They're more intellectually stimulating, but I think I tell a really great story, and I think I tell stories well enough. And that's where I've really focused my effort. That if I believe that if I believe that if I can tell stories well enough, I will remain memorable to those who I get a chance to tell stories to, and I will be of value to the people that engage me to help them tell their stories.
Yeah, you know, you've got this quote called "Life prepares us for greatness," and I really feel that you know, as I look back on my life and having played in the NFL and started some different businesses and now climbing these different mountains, is that by being out there, by being a world traveler, by being surrounded by other phenomenal people that are very gifted at those sports, it's really helped me along the way. I mean, I made it 5 years in the NFL. I was one of those guys that was always scratching and clawing just to try to be there. I wasn't great, but I got to be there with Howie Long and Marcus Allen, Lyle Zato, and these other guys that were great and see their characteristics. It's really helped propel me on what I need to do to help me get to that end. I mean, it's never an end destination, but you know, it's all part of the journey that you go on.
Yeah. And I think you hit it there, Mark. I mean, the one thing I've learned probably as adroitly as anything from many of these great winners is that the truly great understand there is no destination there, right? We are aiming towards something. We're trying to scale that. At, you know, the beauty of a summit, I guess, is that there is truly a peak at the top, but in this journey that we call greatness, there's no true destination, but the joy is really in the journey.
It really is. And the name of the podcast is Finding Your Summit, but it really should be Finding Your Summits. I've said this before, and we all go through different periods of our time, of our lives, you know, again, starting with you, with being a prolific editor for Sports Illustrated, and of course, all these different books you've written, which I want to get into. But where did that first love for you come from, the really passion for the pen?
You know, it's funny, Mark, you know, we were talking before we hit the record button. You know, I say all the time that some of the most incredible things that will happen to you will not be planned. And my path into this space is another example. I grew up in Hawaii. My father was a Methodist pastor, Methodist minister. And we went to Japan, lived in Japan for 2 years. And so we're moving to the continental United States for the first time when I'm 13 years old. And I show up for high school in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I'd registered for classes. And the one elective I'd chosen was ROTC because I thought I would be a good military officer one day. Yeah. And the night before classes were to start, the counselor called the house and said, "By the way, not enough kids signed up for ROTC. We're canceling the program. But don't worry, I'm going to put you on the student newspaper." And so she put me on the student newspaper, and by complete accident, I discovered something that I found that I was good at, right? Which was asking questions and telling stories. And here I am all these years later, as you mentioned, 28 books. Gosh, that sounds like a lot. It is a lot.
It is.
And you get to sit and say, I tell stories for a living. It's a pretty good gig.
No, it's amazing. Did you also have a drive for sports? Because so much of your books have been around sport. I know you do also have a political angle to yourself as well. But, I mean, the focus, and you look at this roster of people that you have associated yourself with, you know, to get in there and really sink your teeth into their life stories has been remarkable. But were you a participant, or were you just always a phenomenal fan of sport, whatever sport that was?
Well, I was a participant at the high school level, and was and just grew to love playing. I would compete at anything if you'd let me, whatever it is, and it remains that way today. I actually just again, I don't know if this one's actually recorded audio only or not, but I actually just took off my arm because my brace. I tore the bicep of my left arm playing basketball 2 weeks ago. In a church league. I'm still at my way past advanced age. I still play sports every day if I can. And I just find amazing value in competing. So even if my wife would say I'm an idiot for continuing to play against 25-year-old kids.
Well, look, I've been invited several times to go play with this group here in Sun Valley, and I have reluctantly said no. I love the sport. I love to be competitive like that. But if I blow an Achilles, if I blow an ACL, man, I am done for Everest. And that's about 11 months from now, and I just cannot risk it.
Don't. That's right. Have a bigger. Now, I was supposed to be playing in about 4 weeks at a basketball camp hosted by Coach K at Duke. He brings a bunch of old guys together every year, and I've gone for the last 6 years, and I was looking forward to going again this year. So I have taken myself out of contention there by doing what I did. But again, if you love to compete and be competitive, it is tough. It is tough to say no when the whistle blows.
All right. So one of the, so I did a bunch of research on you and saw a bunch of different videos and talk about being competitive. You probably went against the all-time competitor, Michael Jordan. So how does somebody get called up to go one-on-one with MJ? And I mean, obviously everybody, I mean, it was probably a fairly easy thing to call that shot and who's going to win that game. But how do you get yourself in that position to even be in the same gym with the guy, let alone going one-on-one with Michael Jordan?
So he happens to have hosted for many years, an old man's camp, where he does it for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. He raises money for Make-A-Wish. And so I got the opportunity. I was invited to the camp through one of his assistants who heard that I love to play the game as actively as I do. And during the camp, he picked out 20 guys and he lined us up and he said, "Today you get to go one-on-one with the greatest player of all time."
It's awesome.
And it's pretty intimidating, right? When somebody gets to introduce themselves as the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
And then I was number 12 on the list and I stepped out. And so I'm going to guess that most of your listeners probably like you assume that immediately the winner of that competition would be Michael Jordan. But I won't ruin the story too greatly, except to say that they would be wrong.
Well, the funny thing is that there's only probably a couple people I can think of in the history of sport where they stand up and they boast that they are the best. And in fact, I don't think anybody would see that as egotistical other than just a plain fact. Muhammad Ali, probably the other guy, right?
Right. Yeah, that's it. When you can tap yourself in the chest and go, today you get to compete with the greatest of all time. As I said, I mean, it just, you're standing in line. You're already thinking your odds are below zero. And he reminds you he's the greatest of all time. For most of us, he's won before we've even walked on the court. And so, but that's what made it fun. That's what he is a. You're not kidding. He's the single most competitive human being I've ever been around.
Yeah, I would also argue that you won before you ever stepped on the court too, right?
Just because I was there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who wouldn't want to trade spots with you in doing that? So
he has joked with me in the years since that I have probably made more money telling the story of one shot made in basketball than anybody on the planet. So I'm okay with that,
That's awesome. Okay, so we go from one of the world's greatest NBA players of all time to Sweetness, right? Mm. So, and I do want to get into that because I got into the league. I was drafted in the 7th round by the Raiders. And so I think it was about 1985 that they went to the Super Bowl, and McMahon and the rest of those cast of characters, they did the Chicago, I can't remember what they called, but
The Super Bowl Shuffle,
and hilarious of all these different guys that were up there doing their thing, and Refrigerator Perry. But in terms of what Walter Payton brought to the table, I mean, he was incredibly disciplined. And talk about this whole theme around greatness. I mean, it just seems to me that that's really a step in the right direction in terms of somebody who can teach us all something about life and what life's all about.
Yeah, no, he was. So I argue that he was not just the greatest football player of all time. Again, that's just my personal opinion, but also one of the greatest humans I've ever gotten to know to walk the planet. I mean, he made people around him better, which, is a real desire of the best. When I asked him, what is it that you think you developed? Where's that habit that you believe kind of ultimately allowed you to separate yourself? A lot of times you look at a guy like him and you're thinking it's something about running a hill or preparation or study. He actually went to the ultimate soft skill, and that was that he really believed that what ultimately put him into a category he was most proud to be part of, it was when he realized that you can't, and he had a John Wooden quote as part of what he would share with me in this conversation, but you can't live a perfect day without doing something for someone who cannot repay you. And he really believed that if he had to pick a habit, an element that would ultimately make him most proud, it's that he made it a daily element of his life from his mid-20s through his death at age 46, to find a way every day to pour into the life of someone who couldn't give him anything in return.
So give me an example of that.
Sure. So one example was occurred during that Super Bowl year. You know, here's everybody on the team. They're just, it's an amazing collection, unbelievable talent. But they also had, as I would learn while we worked together, they had a young woman that was working in the Chicago Bears front office. She was going through a rough patch in her life, and things were so bad between she and her husband at home that her children were having trouble in school, right? Which happens sometimes in moments of marital strife. And Walter Payton knew it, because every day on his way into work, he would stop at her desk and ask her about her children, and she would feel comfortable enough to share this with him. And so five different times during that Super Bowl year, 1985 season, practice ended at 2:00. Everybody else sped out of the parking lot, and Walter walked back to the front desk, tapped her on the shoulder, told her to go home and spend the afternoon with her children. And Walter sat down, put her headset on, and answered phone calls at the front desk of the Bears training company.
Wow. Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
Wow.
And so he believed in that little small way. I mean, that woman could never do anything for him, right? But he did something that changed her life five different times that helped make her relationship with her children different. And that made, in his opinion, those are the moments he's most proud of.
So being such a unselfish guy, when he didn't score the touchdown in the Super Bowl, was that something that sat with him?
Oh, it hurt. Yeah, it bothered him.
Yeah.
Probably didn't bother him as much. It bothered him when it didn't happen, right? But I think it bothered him more a year later when they lost and didn't get a chance to go to the Super Bowl. Because the assumption was, and Ditka even says this, right? Well, I mean, we're going to be back. I mean, this team is, we're on a roll, right? These are the best collection in the NFL. It's the best collection of talent. This team should play the next three Super Bowls. And then the next year they lost in the championship game, didn't make it to the Super Bowl. And Walter never got a chance to play in another Super Bowl and get a chance to score. So yes, it ultimately did bother him, but but it bothered him as much because he was a competitor as, I don't think the number or the record would have mattered to him, but the idea that he'd worked so hard and then there they were in goal line and they gave it to the refrigerator Perry to score and not Walter Payton was crazy, right?
Yeah, no, it was crazy. And if my memory serves me correctly, he also invited you into his house during the final days when he was alive as writing this book and really collaborate.
Correct.
How did that all happen?
He had been diagnosed with a very rare liver disease, and the diagnosis had turned more negative for him. He'd been told he was not going to survive, and he decided that was the time he really needed to focus on writing a book. And he had no idea how long he had left, and so he was looking for a writer. And he'd interviewed a few over the course of several days. And he happened one morning to be watching Oprah Winfrey. And there I was on Oprah. And we'd intersected. We'd had our chances to meet in the past. And so he thought, you know what? He listened to my conversation with Oprah. And he ultimately reached out, called my home, and asked me if I would be willing to come help him tell his story.
That must be a crazy call when somebody named Walter Payton calls you up and you're like, okay, who is this really?
Well, and that was the thing. It actually happened as So Oprah runs earlier in Chicago than it runs in the rest of the country, or it used to, right? Back when she was on every day. Mm-hmm. And so I actually had a group of people gathered at my home to watch Oprah, and the phone rings, buddy of mine answers it. And it's Walter Pate saying, "Hey, by the way, is Don there? I'd like to ask him a question." And they're like, "Can I tell him who's calling?" "Yeah, Walter Payton." And so my buddy's handing me the phone going, "Yeah, this guy says he's Walter Pate."
Yeah.
And then you get on the phone, and within seconds you realize it really was. And the invitation was real. And I flew to Chicago that night.
Incredible. Incredible. And was this during the same time that you were working as an editor for Sports Illustrated, or had you transitioned out and were writing books?
I was at that time still associate editor of Sports Illustrated. Yes.
Yeah. And how many years were you with Sports Illustrated?
12.
12 years. Wow. Well, it certainly gave you the foundation and probably access to many of these different athletes. So you're on Oprah. We'll transition over there. Who's coaching your kid? Right. Mm-hmm. So tell me what that was about.
So it's funny. I was just on the phone with somebody a minute ago, and they were asking me the same question, because when I think of, like, what's the most important story I've ever written, or sometimes people ask that question. It was this story here, and I had learned through sources in the FBI and that there was a national organization of men mostly who were getting into coaching youth sports to get access to children, inappropriate access to children. Yeah. And the FBI was monitoring this group of folks, and they were. And as I began working on it, I began to realize how many people were serving in prison today for having taken advantage of kids that they met through youth sports, coaching, umpiring, doing other things. And you realize that the second piece of that is that most states, in fact, at the time, only one state had a law requiring background checks for youth coaches. And so that's where these pedophiles realized they had an open door. One of the emails I read between two of them actually had the phrase "candy store of opportunity" to describe youth sports as the way they looked at it. And so I went into prison, and I met with men who were sitting in prison cells for having committed this crime. I sat in living rooms with families and children who had suffered the indignities of the crime, and told the story of the importance that we all have to know who's coaching your kid. And out of that story came an invitation to appear on Oprah Winfrey's show, mm-hmm. As well as several others. And in the 12 months following, maybe the greatest thing that I'm, is that more than 36 states changed their laws to require background checks for youth coaches. And so, you know what, you could do a lot of other really cool things, but if in some little small way that helped make a difference, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm a parent of two girls now. They're 20 and 22. And so I totally get, I was a coach myself, a youth coach in volleyball and softball and basketball and everything else it seemed like, but we did have to go through those checks, and I'm sure in some way, some trickle down, it had an effect on what we had to go through. But to think that anybody would be out there trying to stalk or take advantage of my daughters, I don't even know where I'd go with that. But I think it's awesome that you brought awareness to that, that's out there, that if it affected just even one kid, we're better off for that. And so that's an amazing thing that you did. So, kudos. Virtual high five to you. I mean, it's really, really cool. All right. So we're going to be bouncing all over the place just because you've got, you're just like this box of chocolates, and I want to dig into these different aspects of your life, a little bit like Forrest Gump. And 14 years ago, we were talking about, before we went live here, that you went through your own adversity, finding your summit, and had to emerge out of that. You came down with cancer. And I have not been through that, fortunately. I remember watching the movie Brian Song. I'm mm-hmm. sure you've seen it, right? Gail Sayers and Brian Piccolo. And
actually, I watched it with Walter Payton and Matt Sui.
Oh, you did? Really?
Yeah. Who Walter's. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. So anyway, it's funny that, they literally, the fullback and running back of the Chicago Bears when I was going through, when I was working with Walter, you know, we're watching the movie about Brian Piccolo. And
Yeah, I'm very similar, right? The fullback, white guy, Matsui, right? And the black guy and Walter Payton, and the same thing with Brian Piccolo.
Although Walter pointed out to Matt, when Matt said, look at this, Walter's kind of like us. Walter looked at him and said, yeah, but in our story, the black guy gets it in the end. Walter had this like really funny sense of humor about the darkness that he was facing. So.
Yeah, well, I think the whole point is that, you know, I saw that it had a profound effect on me when I was a younger kid. And then, you know, you go through these things when our mind or idle and the little voice inside our head are talking and you're like, gosh, what happens if I ever get that? And what would I do? And unfortunately for you, this happened. And so tell me how you found out about it and tell me how you emerged through the other side and any life's lessons that you took away from coming kind of to the edge of being at stage three.
So, as you and I shared earlier, and I love the game of basketball. I was playing one day. I was 40 years old at the time, and 41. And I was playing in a league, and I took an elbow, and the guy, when he hit me, he hit my nose so hard, he shattered my nose, right?
Yeah.
And it required surgery to go in and rebuild my face, basically. And so in the preparation for the surgery, a couple days later, they were doing all the x-rays, and they were supposed to have stopped it at the chin, but by happenstance, the x-ray ended up about 3 inches lower than that, and it was down into my neck. And so prepping for the surgery, the doctor said, by the way, there's something, you know, that showed up in these x-rays. We're not sure what it is. It just doesn't look right. While we have you under, we're going to check it out. And I come to a few hours later. They say, by the way, successful surgery. Your nose will be fine. It will take you a while, but your nose will look okay. And but we got to tell you, we discovered something there, and you have stage 3 thyroid cancer, and it's spread through the lymph nodes. We have no idea how far, and we don't know what it means, but you need to have surgery again in just a few days.
Yeah.
And then you have to enter a pretty aggressive treatment program that ultimately ended with me spending 3 days in a lead walled room, as they ran, so much radioactive material through me that I was literally radioactive. Like I was a danger to other people.
Yeah, you were on fire.
I was on fire. Yeah. You know, here I am 14 years later. It worked out. But the biggest thing that probably came from that for me was that I'd never spent 3 days alone in my life. Right. And I was required to do that. Obviously, no one around you. Everything I took in the room had to be incinerated. And so I spent 3 days really kind of assessing. I was 40, 41. I'd successful at Sports Illustrated, written books, you know, somewhat, you know, in my own little world, famous, whatever you want to call it, successful financially. What was I missing? Right? What's missing? And what I realized at that moment was that I always thought I would be a dad, and I thought I'd be a pretty good one. I was married at the time, but I was a stepdad. I'd married a woman that had 2 children, mm-hmm. and we intended to have a child of our own. Just didn't happen because we were busy making money and doing things. And suddenly I'm in this room. And when I came out, I sat down with her and we talked, and very plainly, I shared that I shared this experience, and I really felt compelled. I wanted to become a father, and it, you know, wasn't too late for us, I didn't think. And she came back and just didn't make sense in her life, right? Where she was professionally and otherwise, to at 40 plus years old, do that to herself again. And we ultimately would divorce, but not because we hated each other or anything. It was just suddenly life had thrown a different curveball. It had me thinking differently. And a couple of years later, I would meet a woman that I would marry a couple of years after that. And 13 months after the marriage, I would become a father for the first time. And 13 months after that, I would become a father for the second time. And
awesome. At
56, I'm sitting here with a 10-year-old and a 9-year-old. But it's, you know, sometimes in life, we have we never take the time in our challenge to slow down and ask that question, what's missing? And what should I, what out of this should be my lesson? And I was blessed that it worked, that it worked.
Hey, this pod is sponsored by Laird Superfoods. So many products to choose from your InstaFuel, your coffee, your tea, your smoothies. And I love the superfood creamer and use the hydration powders like the beets, the coconut, the matcha, the turmeric to mix all into my 7 Summit smoothie. And it's so good. Log on to LairdSuperfood.com and get your 20% off when you use the code MarkP20, okay? So get your Laird Superfood, and I guarantee it will help fuel your journey.
Yeah, look, there's a bunch of things to unpack here, and I want to go through them. And because there's a lot of similarity. Now, I didn't go through what you're talking about, and I wasn't faced with those different types of things. But as I've mentioned before in this pod, you know, I went through a pretty rough time 7 years ago. I'd been married for 24 years with her for 30. And then all of a sudden she didn't want to be married. And then there's a crossover in terms of something that you talk about, which I really, really like. And some of the speeches that you give, and by the way, you've given hundreds of speeches now around the country. So that's one of the things that Don Yeager does, but you talk about, you know, do you want to be bitter or do you want to be better?
Right.
Right? And I talk about it along the same path. It's really one of those times in life where you're going to choose door number one or door number two. We're talking about the same thing, but
right.
However you want to look at it, it has a profound effect upon the decisions that you make and where you stand today. If I hadn't gone through some of that stuff, I wouldn't be involved in different charities. I wouldn't have started climbing the 7 summits. I wouldn't have had all the kind of experiences that I've had to date. I wouldn't be living in some valley. I mean, my life would be 180 degrees, you know, different from what it is, but because some hard decisions, action had to create a reaction, which had ultimately a positive effect, even though going through it sucked, just like I'm sure when you had to sit in a room and in a brick room, you know, essentially a silo, you couldn't be around anybody for 3 days and really think about life, about where you want to go and the things that are important to you. It's those things that we call timeouts, those breakout sessions, those times that we can really reflect on what the direct path that we want to go in our lives. And I'm happy for you that, you know, even though that was a rough patch, that you've come out the other side and, you know, you sit here at 56 today and you've got a couple kids and, you know, life is probably a lot sweeter than it would have been like if you hadn't, you know, experienced that and kind of put it out there to make some big time life choices.
Totally. I can't even fathom what it would be like without having had those opportunities. And those opportunities wouldn't have happened if the challenge doesn't come my way.
No, I love that. But again, I think that, you know, another one of the things I do talk about a little bit is really stepping into the fear. Right? Because I think that's where the uncomfortable comes in and that's where you find your true greatness. And it's very easy. I mean, it would have been very easy for you just to sit in that relationship. And again, you're not coming away saying it was a bitter relationship or anything. You're just saying, I want more out of life. And so it's fearful when you say, hey, I'm 46 or whatever number you were at the time. And now you're stepping into the world of singlehood, which isn't fun. At least it wasn't for me. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. And just like, what is your life? Which way are you going to spin? Who are going to end up? Will anybody ever want me? You know, and you go through that whole phase, you know, and it's challenging and it puts you in a spin. And, but I try to encourage people to step into the fear. Now you're not going to go across the 405 in LA, you know, on the freeway at rush hour, you know, and that's not what I'm talking about, but I mean, you can't hold back. And Tim McGraw's got a great song about living like you're dying, right? And that means a lot to me.
Yeah. I had the chance to work with Tim and his father, Tug, as well. And I served on Tim's foundation board for several years. Listening, if you've ever watched him sing that song, I mean, it's really, really powerful the way he, because it's an amazing question, right? What would happen if we were living like we were dying? Right.
Yeah, you'd go all out, right? I mean, there'd be nothing that you were, you got 20 days to live. What are you going to do about it? Right. My best friend's Jim Mora, head coach of the Falcons and the Seahawks for a short spell, and then UCLA the last 6 years, and he just got back from the NFL draft announcing down there. He sent me this great video over the weekend of Tim McGraw pulled him up on stage, and they threw footballs out to the 300,000 plus that were out there cheering nice. On their team and the draft and everything else. But it was really cool because Tim was playing. And during one of his songs where the band was going, they're chucking footballs around and hugging and high-fiving. And I was like, man, there's something wrong with this picture. And the picture is that I am not in it.
Yeah, I know.
So tell me about, as we transition out here a little bit, tell me about Tug, because he had a kind of a controversial life. He's known as having a great saying back in his day when he
was. You got to believe.
You got to believe. And they did. And they went on. But I don't think he met Tim McGraw, the famous country music star, until he was older in his life, right?
Yeah. So Tim was the product of a one-night stand that Tug had with a woman in Jacksonville, Florida. And Tug would not know that Tim even existed until Tim was 11. And it's just the intersection, how their lives would then kind of come together, grow apart, come together, grow apart. I mean, just, I loved working with the two of them when the telling of that story. But yes, Tug did not know that he had fathered a child in that encounter, and until years later.
So how did that get revealed?
So the grandmother of Tim's grandmother actually had said, by the way, we need to Tim needed. The mom had was going through a divorce with the man she married after she came back to Louisiana, and she was trying to figure her life out. And 10 years, Tim's born. He actually grows up as Tim Smith, because that was the name of the other man until he discovers that he's actually his father. On his birth certificate was listed as Frank E. Tug McGraw, and so Tim asked his mom, I want to meet my dad, and they arranged a meeting through the Mets who Tug was pitching for at the time, when the Mets were playing in Houston, and Tug was fun and funny, and threw him some baseballs, did other things, but didn't really believe that was really his son. He was just trying to be nice about it, and a few years later. When it was time for Tim to go off to college, the mom reached out again, and now Tug's with the Phillies at that stage. And he agrees to meet again, this time to take a DNA test, right, to prove paternity, if that was true. And so he's sitting there in a hotel lobby. In walks Tim and his mom, and Tug looks at the lawyer and says, cancel the test. I mean, look at him. I mean, he's my son. I mean, they look a lot. A young Tim and a young Tug looked exactly alike. They even walked alike. And so Tug looks at Tim, says, look, I'll help you make your way through college. But you could hate me for the rest of your life if you want to, or you can forgive me and we can move forward. And Tim agrees to forgive, and they begin a relationship that turned out to be pretty incredible.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, it's big of both of them not to hold on to that resentment after all said and done. And, I've known some different people who were born as orphans, and, there's just some stuff in their background that, it's hard to explain, but it's just, there's a rub there, and understandably so. I had great parents, and I'm sure you did too. And just not to have that and not to have that dad in your life, that father figure, would be very tough.
Yeah. And then, and ultimately when Tug falls ill, got a brain tumor, Tim cancels concerts to go be by his side, which was really incredible, and to arrange treatment for him to make sure that he got the best treatment available. And though Tug was told he only had a few days to live when the tumor was discovered, they extended out through Tim's efforts and medical treatment to almost 10 months that they got together at the end of his life. And that was the part in which I got hired to come work with them to kind of help tell the story. So.
Wow. Now, had Tim McGraw become Tim McGraw by that point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most importantly, he was married to Faith Hill by that point. So let's just get to what really matters.
Oh, well, that does matter. he did okay.
Yeah.
So listen, speaking of what Tim was able to pull off with Faith, because she's the true star of the family, and we're talking about now 16 characteristics of greatness. Give me a couple nuggets that you have found over time.
Sure. So the first one, the one that I think I apply as actively for myself as any of them, is John Wooden once taught me that you'll never outperform your inner circle. You'll never be better than the people you have around you. And by your inner circle, it doesn't mean the people you wish you spent time with or the people you occasionally talk to. It's the people you give your time to. Who are those people? As you look at the group that you have around you, where are they headed? Are they headed where you're headed? Do they want what you want? And if they don't, your responsibility to yourself is to change your circle, right? Improve your inner circle.
Yeah.
And Coach Wooden used to say that all the time, regularly. You need to be evaluating your inner circle, asking yourself, is this a reflection of who I want to be? And Coach Wooden's encouragement to me and instruction to me on doing that became a really important part, and has become a really important part for the last 15 years of my life. I'm regularly evaluating my circle.
Love that. Staying on the John Wooden theme. So this is a guy, again, I speak a lot, and I speak a lot about him because there was such a profound effect on my life. My head coach at University of Washington, I didn't know this at the time, of course, but he would turn out to be a Hall of Fame coach, Don James.
Don James, yeah.
Yep. We went to several Rose Bowls. We won the conference championship several times. But, you know, when I first got to the University of Washington, I was 6'2", 181 pounds. I couldn't bench my weight. I really never had to work for anything I did. It was football came very naturally to me, and I really didn't have to work, right? And then when I got as a freshman, I looked out on the field, and what I saw was a bunch of other 20, 21, 22-year-old guys who are gunned up, confident, big, strong, fast. And that was not me. And really the path, as he told it to me, was like, look, kid, if you want to make it here, then you got to put in the work and you got to do the time. And that's really understanding John Wooden's pyramid of success, which is more or less, as you know, a 25 team and individual building blocks to help anybody get to the pinnacle of whatever they're trying to do. And for me, that, you know, I had to dig in and dig hard. And they, I mean, I always went through like 3 years of hard time. There were a lot of dark days. And the thing about that too, is that there was no certainty on the other end. Mm-hmm. Right. But what it did is it gave me a foundation that I've applied towards my life in terms of daily discipline of things I need to do to try to get to whatever I'm trying to achieve. And, so anyways, it was interesting because Coach James had made that pyramid his own. And, you know, obviously we were trying to win the Pac-12, actually back then it was the Pac-10 championship and go to the Rose Bowl. We weren't going to the NCAA, you know, basketball tournament, of course. But, you know, again, I say that foundational building block of really understanding and applying those things to me to this day towards these mountains I'm climbing, towards these different businesses, has really had a profound effect, you know, on my life and what he's had to say.
Yeah. I love, you know, Coach Wooden, when you look at his pyramid, right, the top block, the piece that you're aiming toward is titled competitive greatness, right? That's what he believed the top block was. And this, the definition of that as he has it on his pyramid is, you know, the ability to be your best when your best is needed, right? And that's the preparedness, that willingness, that a moment creates itself for you. Are you ready? Are you capable of being your best in that moment? And it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen without work. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen without effort. And so the ability to kind of prepare yourself through the elements of the pyramid to prepare yourself for competitive greatness is, to me, it's one of my favorite. I love Coach Wooden's pyramid. It's all over my office. I have it all over the place.
Well, if you come up to West Palm on Friday, you'll see me talking about it. And I actually put that graphic up as well. And again, I mean, it's to your point. Again, I as a freshman, I got to play here and there. I didn't letter anything, but I couldn't have been in the position to play and be competitive and have greatness and help the team because, excuse me, because I hadn't put myself in that position, you know, at that level yet to really understand what that was going to take to compete against those different guys at UCLA, USC, Stanford, and other teams that we played. So anyways, it was just a, you know, again, an incredible guy. And I'm so thankful that I did end up going to the University of Washington, and Don James had taken such an affinity towards Coach Wooden and the principles that he had to teach. So I want to switch over just a little bit because I was reading about this. So although we've been talking all about sports and books and everything else, Sports Illustrated, there is this great a piece that I was reading about, and I'm going to hack up the name, so excuse me on this, but tell me about when you're in Afghanistan and you're out there, you know, when the Soviets invaded and you're writing, journaling. I mean, how did you even end up with that invite? I mean, where would that come from? What were you up to? I mean, I have to imagine just like, you know, when we were really in the thick of things over there that, you know, at times it was pretty intense.
Yeah, it's crazy. So there's a large frame on the wall of our home that has the front page of the special section of a newspaper that I did about the Holy War, the Afghans' fight against the Soviets. And my children pointed out a few months ago that when they looked up there, I was there in November of 1988. So it was 30 years ago. It's crazy. That's how old I am.
Yeah.
But
I'm right there with you, baby.
I was working for a newspaper that was at the time was based in Jacksonville, Florida. The newspaper was, and when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, many of the intellectuals of that country fled because they didn't want to be oppressed. And so the two cities that they ended up with in the greatest numbers were Detroit and Jacksonville, Florida, for whatever reason. So I happened to meet a number of some of these Afghan, specifically doctors, who had left the country. But part of their pilgrimage that they gave to, that they required of themselves every year was to go back and support the Mujahideen, the fighters who were battling the Soviets, by offering them medical treatment. And they shared with me they were headed back to Afghanistan, and I was invited to join them. And I was just young and dumb enough to do it. And so we flew to Pakistan and walked through the Khyber Pass into Afghanistan and spent several weeks there as part of an effort, A, for these doctors to treat injured Mujahideen, and then also to participate in the Mujahideen's effort to actually attack a Soviet military encampment. And so, yeah, it was a crazy thing to do as a young reporter, but one I wouldn't do today, but a series of lessons and amazing stories that I'll be able to carry with me for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you're older, you're wiser, you have kids now. But what's the one thing that you can think of? And maybe there's a bunch of things, but this is one of the bunch of the things that are in there that you walked away, like you learned from, or just gave you new insights, or, you know, maybe it's just the value of life or something.
Well, no, I think, you could throw value of life and all kinds of things in there. But I think the one thing that really stood out to me is an inferior foe with a greater mission statement. You know, with a greater belief that their role and their reason for being was had an opportunity, as they showed there, and as has been shown many times in military history, to outfight a superior opponent.
Yeah, that's that whole thing about why, right? Yep. I mean, if you have a strong why, man, look out.
Yeah, I mean, these were children. I mean, I was walking alongside 10-year-olds, my son's age, who were carrying rifles, and willing to do whatever it took to get the Soviets to leave their country. And that was important to them, and that was their lifestyle. And the Soviets didn't bring the same passion to the fight, right? And ultimately, we know they
backed out,
packed up, and left. Yeah,
yeah. And then here we went, right?
That's right.
So. Yeah. So okay, look at rounding third base here a little bit as we wind towards the end of the pod. What book are you working on? We talked about, I said you've actually written 28 books. I think your 28th book is coming out shortly. So to be accurate, that's what it is. And what book, what's your subject?
So 28 comes out in a couple weeks. I don't know when this podcast runs, but it's with Joe Namath.
Oh, lucky dog.
Yeah. And it was an incredible run kind of working with him. And then number 29 is done in the can and comes out this fall, and it's with the youngest recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, a young man who was in Afghanistan a few years ago as a 19-year-old Marine, and the Taliban launched a grenade that landed between he and his best friend, and he dove on the grenade to save his buddy.
Wow.
And 71 surgeries later, he ran the Marine Corps Marathon.
What's his name?
His name is Kyle Carpenter. Single most extraordinary story I've ever been asked to tell.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible. Wow. Well, that's a great way to end the pod. Listen, I so appreciate you coming on the podcast. I know I've been chasing you around the block, you know, for a number of months. I feel like I've now realized my competitive greatness by landing you and having you on and telling your stories. So I appreciate that very much. Mark, and this will run in a couple of weeks. So again, I greatly appreciate it.
Honored to get a chance to do it. And I hope that those who listen to you will, in some ways, through your show notes or whatever it is, get a chance to connect.
I always like to grow
and learn too.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, listen, I do want to. There will be show notes, but if you just verbally want to give a quick shout out, your website, go ahead.
Sure. Website is just donyaeger.com, donyaeger.com. We're doing a lot of fun things right now between books, and we actually have our first virtual learning course is just going live recently, where we're teaching some of the habits of greatness in a way that is it's virtually deliverable, which is kind of fun, and speaking, and all the piece parts are coming together. It's pretty exciting.
Well, that's why you've been so elusive trying to capture here on the pod, is just because you do have a lot of things going on with all your public speaking. So again, appreciate it so much for coming on, and this will run in a couple of weeks, and I'll let you know.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye. Hey, thank you so much for dropping in and listening to another amazing episode of Finding Your Summit. Truly incredible people doing spectacular things in life, and I hope you were inspired just like I continue to be. Look, I am super grateful that you came in and subscribed to this pod and would be more than appreciative if you gave the show a ratings and review on iTunes. Trust me, it matters. And then also go share it with your friends, of course. Okay, until next week, go do something great, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.